Support for this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is brought to you by MX Publishing, with the largest catalog of new Sherlock Holmes books in the world. New novels, biographies, graphic novels, and short story collections about Sherlock Holmes. Find them at mxpublishing.com.
And by the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, episode 212, All Things ACD.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became a chronicler.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Bigger Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Wolder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Hi! Welcome once again to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the world's first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees, where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
I'm Burt Wolder.
And Burt, how are you today, my friend?
Oh, my goodness. There aren't words in the dictionary to describe how overnaturally fabulous I am today, Scott.
Well, that's fantastic because I don't have a dictionary at hand. I mean, there's one across the office here, but I don't have time to look things up.
Oh, drat.
Well, if you would like to look things up related to this show, you can do so by going to ihose.co/ihose212. That'll take you directly to the show notes on this episode on ihearofsherlock.com. You can also find us all over the socials at ihearofsherlock. And if you'd like to reach out, we'd love to hear from you. You can call us at 734-221-READ. Again, that's 734-221-7323. Or send us an email at comment@ihearofsherlock.com. We would love to hear from you, and we have a remarkable show lined up for you today. Now, it's not often we have a chance to sit down with not only one, not only two, but three guests at one time. It's a little bit of a risk at times because, well, things can get a little crazy. But we're going to try our best here because we're going to be dialing in, I think, via seance to Conan Doyle to help us with our guests today. First up, we have Ross Davies. Ross got a BA from Washington University and a JD from the University of Chicago. He lives in Washington, D.C., and he associates with the Red Circle. He teaches at George Mason University. The standard epigraph in his course materials is, quote, "Nothing clears up a case so much as stating it to another person," unquote. Most of his Sherlockian writing has had legal or cartographical angles, or both. He edits The Green Bag, which describes itself as an entertaining journal of law, and its satellite publications, greenbag.org, and operates a website devoted to Sherlockian toasts. He is invested in the BSI as the temple. Ross, welcome to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere.
Thank you, Scott. And I will thank you too, Bert.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Clifford Goldfarb. Cliff received a BA in Arts and a JD in Law from the University of Toronto and an LLM from the London School of Economics. He was Myers, or president, of the Bootmakers of Toronto for 1978, and he's currently chair of the Friends of the Arthur Conan Doyle Collection at the Toronto Reference Library. His Doylean books include Investigating Sherlock Holmes, Solved and Unsolved Mysteries with Hartley Nathan, The Great Shadow, Arthur Conan Doyle, Brigadier Gerard, and Napoleon. He's contributed articles to several BSI publications, and he specializes in charitable and nonprofit organizations, and he's published extensively in that area. Cliff lives in Toronto with his wife Doris and enjoys his two children and seven grandchildren, and he was invested in the BSI as Fordham, the Horsham lawyer. How about that? Cliff, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
Excellent. And finally, last but certainly not least, is Ashley Polasek, PhD. Ashley is an internationally recognized expert in the study of Sherlock Holmes adaptations. Both her MA thesis and doctoral dissertation interrogated the subject of Holmes on screen. And she's published several academic articles in leading journals and presented numerous papers exploring various aspects of Sherlockian film and television throughout the U.S., U.K., and Europe. She's a frequent reviewer for the Oxford University Press's Adaptation and a member of both the Association of Adaptation Studies and the Literature Film Association. She's proud to be a point of contact for scholars seeking to publish about Holmes's screen afterlives. Ashley lives in South Carolina with her Wheaton Terrier Jekyll and her husband, Mr. Hyde, and is a member of the newest class of the Baker Street Irregulars, where this year she was invested as Single Stick. Ashley, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back, I should say. You've been a guest here, gosh, how many times now?
This is my sixth time.
My gosh, does it ever get any easier?
You know, it really doesn't. Really doesn't.
Well, I'm glad we're living up to our standards then.
I didn't know that I needed a JD to be a guest on this one, by the way, so if I need to go back and get a different degree, please give me a little more advance notice.
You know, I should mention that for our lauded guests here, I was reading their biographies from a couple of publications that would be of interest to our listeners. Ashley's came from Sherlock Holmes Behind the Canonical Screen, and that's papers from the conference held at the UCLA School of Theater, Film, and Television back in August and September of 2012. And Cliff's and Ross's biographies came from Canon Law, Lawyers, Law, and the Sherlockian Canon from the BSI Press. We'll have links to both of those books in the show notes if you're interested. So we are here ostensibly not necessarily to talk specifically about Sherlock Holmes, but another associated figure with Sherlock Holmes, and that is this fellow named Arthur Conan Doyle. Cliff, I think you've probably been associated with this fellow for as long as anyone, or longer than anyone here, and in an intimate way. Tell us a little bit about how you became enamored with Conan Doyle.
Well, I got put in my place a couple of weeks ago at BSI annual weekend when I said I came to Conan Doyle through Sherlock Holmes like everybody else, and then Douglas Kerr managed to put me in my place by explaining that he and many other people had come directly. I was a Sherlockian. I enjoyed the Sherlock Holmes stories, and it occurred to me at some point that this guy who wrote these stories, and I'm talking about a doctor who's not named Watson, was actually one heck of a good writer. I've often said, you could write the telephone book and you would enjoy reading it. And I thought, why don't I try some of his other things? And I did. And over time, I've read almost all of his fiction. I've yet to read A History of the First World War, but I'm sure it reads well. It's just that it's so many volumes, I can't spare the month or two it would take.
Now, do you remember your first non-Sherlock Holmes piece by Conan Doyle that you read? Does that stand out to you?
No, it was so many years ago, I can't remember now. It was probably one of his novels, though.
Well, having had that experience, Cliff, having come to Conan Doyle via Sherlock Holmes, if there was someone out there who said, I'm interested in something other than Sherlock Holmes, I'm really interested in the works of Conan Doyle, where would you recommend they begin?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that question. Bigger at your heart. Yes. Well, that's not my, that's not the one I annotated, but yeah, Brigadier Gerard is a character that he created right after he killed off Sherlock Holmes. And I guess he needed an income. And he created another serial character that he wrote 18 stories about, or 17, depending on how you count them. And it's almost the total opposite end of the spectrum from Sherlock Holmes. It's a French soldier who is extremely good at fighting and extremely bad at seeing himself. And he's told through his own voice, which is, again, proof of how good a writer Conan Doyle was, because he can only make Sherlock Holmes exceptional by showing him through the eyes of John Watson, every man. And then he creates this other character who is only viable because he's seen through his own eyes and his own total inability to see himself. So I would certainly recommend them. They're beautifully written. They're humorous. They're historically accurate. Conan Doyle loved them. He put his heart and soul into them. And you know, anyone who reads them enjoys them, and they're probably his best-kept secret.
Yeah. Oh, I'm a big fan of the Brigadier Gerard stories, and I think you're absolutely right. It's a great place to start. But what about your comment that there are 17 or 18, depending on how you count them? What's that all about?
Well, there's one story that is really in two parts. It was published, each story was published in a separate issue of the Strand magazine, but there's one story that was set at the Battle of Waterloo that's an actually, so it's one story, the Brigadier of Waterloo, but it's in two different parts. I count them as two stories, but they're the only stories. They're not the only stories, but the only two that are really connected to each other. Like the Sherlock Holmes stories, they're, each one is a separate story, but this pair happens to connect. If you read the first one without reading the second one, the other way around. If you read the second one without reading the first one, you won't get the entire context.
Mm. And do I gather that you've produced an annotated version of the Gerard stories?
No, I've written a book that attempts to analyze everything that Conan Doyle wrote that had to do with the Napoleonic era.
Ah.
And the Gerard stories are the most important part of that, but he wrote three novels. He, The Great Shadow, Uncle Bernac, and Rodney Stone. He wrote a bunch of short stories, one of which was called A Straggler of 15, which was purchased, turned into a play, which became Waterloo, which was the piece that Henry Irving used to present as his own signature piece for many years. He wrote the novel Rodney Stone, which is probably the best of the Napoleonic novels. And then that became a play, The House of Temperley, which is mainly about boxing. He wrote a few other short stories. I don't repeat the entire catalog, but it was quite a, you know, quite a complete series of writing.
Well, and the lovely thing about your comment now, Cliff, is that it really sets up this whole episode, because, you know, you can be an admirer of Joseph Conrad, you can be an admirer of Robert Louis Stevenson, as we are, but there are very few writers who produced humorous stories, short stories, Napoleonic stories, English history stories, plays, poems. You know, the range of Conan Doyle's output is not widely understood by people who only look at him through the lens of Sherlock Holmes.
Yes, and then he wrote nonfiction, and one of my favorite of his total nonfiction books is Magic Door, which is essentially wandering around his library, pulling something out and writing about it. And there's a whole chapter in there about Napoleon, which gives a different view of Napoleon. His take on Napoleon in the Gerard stories and the other novels is one thing, and then his take on it in The Magic Door is different, which shows you how broad his mind was and how he could wrap himself around an idea and then communicate it.
We've had whole episodes we've had to cut off where Bert was wandering around his library too. It didn't play well for the audience. So, you know, it's interesting to me, you know, throughout his entire career, you know, Conan Doyle was obviously most well known for the Sherlock Holmes stories. Those spanned, you know, probably about 40 years or so, off and on throughout his writing career. And yet, Cliff, as you say, his bibliography is so much broader and so much deeper. And yet, here we have, still extant today, the Baker Street Irregulars and all of the science societies and non-science societies around the world that are dedicated to Sherlock Holmes, whereas there aren't that many just dedicated to Conan Doyle, or any until your cabal here on the show decided to come up with some plans. And the reason we asked you on, and I'll get to a question in a moment because I know you're hanging on the edge of your microphone there. The reason we asked all of you on is because there seems to be some great confluence of thinking, of a push toward an acknowledgement of Conan Doyle. So, Cliff, I want you to kind of help us step back in time and understand perhaps the Conan Doyle sons and what they thought of the BSI and what efforts there were to honor Conan Doyle himself in the years following.
That's a good question. There have been a number of things written about the Conan Doyle's sons, or one of them, Dennis, attending a famous dinner of the BSI way back in the 1940s, I think it was, and discovering that they thought his father was Watson's literary agent. And I don't think either of his sons understood what it meant to play the game. And I don't think that there was disrespect towards Conan Doyle, but they wanted Conan Doyle to be put first and foremost. And it did sour relationships somewhat. Of course, Adrian could have a great relationship with anyone who wanted to pay good money for the rights to use any of the stories. But they were also very disappointing. I mean, these were two sons of... I always say that Conan Doyle had no... I don't know what the word is. There's a Yiddish word for it, which I won't use, but he got no joy out of his family. He had five children, one of whom tragically died at the end of World War I, one of whom Mary never married, one of whom Jean married late, and then the two boys who married essentially socialites never had children. So five children and no grandchildren. That's enough to sour any parent, I think. Adrian and Dennis were playboys. I mean, they lived off of the estate. I don't think anyone, either of them, was ever really productive, although Adrian tried to turn Conan Doyle into a commercial enterprise with the Baskerville Corporation and making movies and so on.
So you're saying they were neither productive nor reproductive?
Well, they might have been, but we don't know about any of the reproductions.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we've seen that as acknowledged through certainly Edgar Smith's interactions with Adrian in the 40s and 50s. Adrian had a tendency to be hot-headed in his approach with a lot of these things, and Edgar's nickname for him was Adrenaline Conan Doyle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Aptly noted. So when did fan-minded people finally decide, you know, Conan Doyle needs some acknowledgement himself. Conan Doyle needs a society. Conan Doyle perhaps needs, you know, something dedicated to him.
Well, there was an Arthur Conan Doyle Society that was founded about, I don't know the exact date, around 1985 or towards the end of the 80s. And it went for about 10 years. And the founders essentially ran out of enthusiasm and it just died. No one took it on when they let it go. And it produced a journal. I see that Bert actually has a copy of it, the Journal of the ACD Society, which was a superb publication, although they did allow me to write something for it once. So, it's by the way, it's going to be, or it has recently been digitized and maybe reissued in digital form.
Well, that's fantastic. So, speaking of journals, let's bring Ashley back into the conversation, because this is where we begin to see a confluence of events. We've we heard from Cliff about the Journal of the Arthur Conan Doyle Society. And then I remember, I don't know, maybe 2 years ago, Ashley, you kind of popped your head up from your virtual internet groundhog hole, wherever it is. And you said, hey, anyone interested in something I'm tentatively calling the Conan Doyle Review? Can you tell us a little bit about the germination for that idea and where it went?
Sure. Well, as so many things do, it began with an email from Ross saying, do you have time for a phone call? And Ross is a sort of magical unicorn of a person who has lots of ideas, incredible work ethic, and no ego. And so he comes up with these fabulous ideas for things that need to exist. He finds people who he thinks are going to be the sort of people who will make them exist in the way that they ought to, and then sort of leaves the space open for them to do that and provides any support without taking any credit, which is a unique set of qualities in any human, I think you'll agree. So that conversation happened a few years ago, maybe about 3 years ago. And it was really the idea that there isn't a space for scholarship on Conan Doyle, really, and there should be. So there are wonderful publications, obviously, for Sherlockian articles, and the Baker Street Journal is wonderful. But when we talk about a scholarly endeavor, something where you're dealing with double-blind peer review and the academic process, there are all sorts of people all over the world who write articles, present papers at conferences, teach Conan Doyle in a huge range of disciplines. But because there's no central space for us to share our scholarship with one another, we don't really find each other than by happenstance or by personal networking. And so the idea was, why shouldn't there be a scholarly journal about Conan Doyle? As Cliff has pointed out, he was incredibly prolific. And there is such a range of material that hasn't had a kind of academic scrutiny placed on it that should. And there are people who want to do that work or who even are doing that work, and we're just not seeing it because it's not popping up in the spaces that are in front of us. And so I wanted to provide a space for that. As somebody who is, I live in the space between academia and Sherlockiana, I am a good person to facilitate that. So we've been working hard behind the scenes to get all of the infrastructure that most people probably don't recognize as necessary, but things like, software that facilitates the double-blind peer review. So when you submit, it strips all your metadata off an article, and we can build networks of people who are capable of doing academic review, building a website where these things can be published open access, getting the kind of memberships required to assign DOI numbers to articles so that scholars can have their work available to them without fees, and all the sort of boring stuff that goes into creating this kind of journal, so that when we open for submissions, which is going to happen shortly, stay tuned for an announcement. We're going to be opening for submissions this spring. All of that infrastructure will already exist so that we can be a place to publish that scholarship for people.
Ashley, for those of our listeners who, might not be connected to the trappings, the framework, the puts and takes of academic publishing like this, do you have, in your mind, an example of what, and you say, you're about to open for submission. So it might be useful for some of our listeners to get, a sense of the kind of art. When you talk about scholarship that would turn into a paper in a journal about Conan Doyle, what sort of thing, what are some sort of titles, some areas that you think you know, might constitute that content.
Sure. So we're an interdisciplinary journal, which means you can be in any, you can be publishing in any discipline or doing your scholarship in any discipline. So my expectation is we'll get a lot of work from people who study literature, because obviously, but also, you know, maybe you have you know, an interest in talking about Conan Doyle's medical career, or maybe you want to talk about his research process that he goes through to understand, you know, the Napoleonic Wars, as, you know, Cliff was saying. Maybe rather than looking at the work of literature, you're actually looking at Conan Doyle's process. And we want to be really open about the kind of things we accept. So we're looking at his works, so the stuff that he produced, fiction and nonfiction, his life. So if you are interested in any attribute of his biography, we're interested in articles on that. His creative afterlives, that means anything that another creator has made that originated somehow with Conan Doyle. So adaptations are in there, translations are in there, of course, derivative works are in there. And cultural legacies. So anything that's a kind of sociocultural aftershock of Conan Doyle's life or works, all of that is fair game too. If you are not used to reading academic articles, I will give you guys my my academia.edu page, where I have a couple of my own articles that are on Sherlock Holmes adaptations. So they might be interesting to people. But even as models, they can see the kind of length and depth and language that's associated with this kind of writing. I will also say that I am producing a fairly lengthy kind of how-to introduction article for the journal, just so people can understand who we are, what we're trying to do, what kind of material we're looking for, and exactly what the process is behind the scenes. Because even people who are used to publishing in academic journals, if they're not used to the behind-the-scenes work that the editors do, they often don't know. There's a feeling very much that you pour your heart and soul into, you know, 6,000 words and you send it off into the void and you hope that the reviewers are kind or understand what you're trying to do. And because the process is anonymized, you don't often get to understand exactly what you did right and what you did wrong necessarily. So our review process is going to be very open. So all the feedback that the reviewers give to the editors will also go to the authors. And that article will walk you through that process so you can see exactly what that looks like.
And who is the editing team that you've put together, Ashley?
Sure. So I'm the editor-in-chief, and our senior team is three. It's me. Our associate editor is Kate Bromley. You may know Kate's work from her PhD work with Portsmouth, with the Richard Lansing Green bequest. And our... she's senior associate editor. Associate editor is Mary Alcaro, and Mary is finishing her PhD at Rutgers. Now, Mary's scholarship hasn't been in Conan Doyle. She's a medieval literature scholar. However, Mary and I are working together on a proposal for a book that will be about Conan Doyle that will showcase that this is her wheelhouse also.
Oh, fantastic. Can't wait to see that. You have a tentative title?
Not yet.
Okay. Early on.
That one's very early days.
Excellent. Yes. Now, does the Conan Doyle Review have a web presence where people can go and find out more information?
We do have a website. We haven't announced the link yet, but I will be happy to give you guys the link to post alongside this episode.
Superb.
You're on
Twitter.
Sorry, that space will be... Yes, we're on Twitter.
Okay. As ACD Review. Okay. Yes. All right. Well, we will have the links to all of those in the show notes for everyone to check out, as well as to Ashley's academia.edu page that she so generously volunteered for us. So, when will you begin accepting submissions to the Conan Doyle Review?
We're going to open at the beginning of April.
Oh, superb! Oh, what great
timing!
We'll
accept on a rolling submissions, rolling publication. So as quickly as something can make it through the process of review and, you know, proofreading and copy editing and typesetting, it will get published open access online and be available to read.
Great. And when is your expectation for the first full edition of the review to be released to the public?
So what we'll do is everything gets published online, open access, so you can read everything we do without paying. But everything will then get collected once a year that will be published bound with the Baker Street Almanac. And we expect to have that. Ross, are we looking at 2023, I guess?
We are looking at whenever it's ready to roll. This is this. If I may just say right now about this, the Conan Doyle Review is such a well-conceived and professionally and scholarly executed project that I very much suspect that what's going to happen is in 2023, the Conan Doyle Review will be published and bound in print with the Baker Street Almanac. And by 2030, what people will be saying is that the Baker Street Almanac is public and print and bound with the Conan Doyle Review. This is speaking purely just as an academic, just as someone who shares the ivory tower with Ashley. This project is a huge deal, not just for the Sherlockian Doylean world, but for literary studies. This is very, very exciting.
That's fantastic to hear. Well, we will hear more from Ross and our other guests right after this quick word.
Sherlock Holmes and Arthur Conan Doyle have been topics of conversation in the world of literature ever since 1895. Wouldn't it be great to look through all those discussions? Have all those articles, reviews, and commentary in one place on your bookshelf? Now you can, because the Wessex Press has published Sherlock Holmes, Conan Doyle, and The Bookman. All the pastiches, parodies, letters, all the columns and commentaries about Sherlock Holmes from 1895 to 1933 from the finest literary magazine of the 20th century, The Bookman, in one place, bringing back dozens of long-lost commentaries about the chronicles of Sherlock Holmes. Don't wait until this handsome volume is out of print. Get your copy of Sherlock Holmes, Conan Doyle, and The Bookman right now at WessexPress.com.
Okay, we're back talking all things ACD with Ashley Polasek and Cliff Goldfarb and Ross Davies. Ross, we mentioned the Baker Street Almanac just before the break there. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what the Baker Street Almanac is all about and where the idea sprung from?
The Baker Street Almanac is, the idea behind it is that it's this is sort of the subtitle of it, I guess. It's an annual time capsule of not everything. You could never put everything, you know, between covers, but of lots and lots of stuff that happened in the previous year in the Sherlockian Doylean world. And you know, I'm not sure what the original prompt for it was, but it sprang at least partly from an appreciation of the history of the Baker Street Irregulars that John Lellenberg wrote in large part and orchestrated pretty much in its entirety for the first couple of decades, recovering the first couple of decades of the BSI. And the thought was that as time goes on and things hurry up and more things are electronic and ephemeral, even more ephemeral than ephemera, it would be nice if 100 years from now, when John Lellenberg VII is writing the history of the BSI in the early 21st century, if there was a place to go and just see what happened that year. And so that's all the Baker Street Almanac is. It's a picture of the year. And it turns out that even taking a partial quick snapshot of a year in the Sherlockian world, it fills hundreds of pages. And so, in fact, in I think the same spirit as the Conan Doyle Review, what we do is we publish the thing in its entirety online in searchable PDF form. And then we put out a limited edition in print. And the print edition includes, or has historically and will again this year, include various ephemeral odds and ends that are there mostly just for the fun of it. So the Baker's Yard Almanac is basically a big fat book about last year.
Well, and for anyone who hasn't gotten a copy of the Baker Street Almanac, please do. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. It's a really, really impressive publication. And considering that this is done on the side as a hobby, you know, from Ross, who actually has some experience with the Green Bag, as we mentioned in his biography, he publishes stuff on a regular basis from a variety of people. And this is yet another one of those things. So make sure you check out the Baker Street Almanac either online and or get that print publication, because it's absolutely handsome.
I would like to add, if I may, one thing about this year's, the forthcoming, which will be out in a few weeks, Baker Street Almanac, that fits particularly neatly with what we're talking about today.
Please.
And for that, if I may defer to Cliff, who is the co-author of a small book that is going to appear within the Baker Street Almanac about ACD. Cliff?
Yes, so this is the 50th anniversary of the Conan Doyle collection at the Toronto Reference Library. And Ross had published a bit about the history of the Norwegian explorers of Minneapolis, Minnesota, and asked me if we would be interested in having something about the history of the Conan Doyle collection. And I believe it was originally going to be scheduled for next year, because Ross likes to plan ahead. And I said, well, how about this year, because it's our 50th anniversary? So he said yes. And I have to give all the credit to Jesse Amalo, who's the curator of the collection, who really did all of the hard work. And I just helped with the editing. But I also want to mention very briefly that the Baker Street Irregulars did have a project, the history series, to do a book for every decade of the Baker Street Irregulars. John Lellenberg was going to do up to the end of 1950, although he only got to the beginning. And then there were people assigned to the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. And the 90s, although the 90s writer backed off right away. And the other, I won't mention names, although unfortunately Susan Rice, who was one of the editors, died very recently and lamentably. I was going to do the 80s, and I did a lot of research. And then I just felt somehow that it wasn't right to publish a history of something that I was right in the middle of. It would be more of a newspaper type of publication, especially since the 60s and the 70s authors both begged off. So it was going to be a huge gap, because the 50s weren't being written either. And so I'm now producing a series of essays based on that. And Ross has looked at one of them, which I hope will be published in the Baker Street Journal shortly. Again, it's nothing to do with Sherlock Holmes. It's everything to do with a social history of the Baker Street Irregulars and the people around it. So to have something like the Baker Street Almanac come along and create that. So it's what the kind of thing that I didn't have when I was writing. I didn't have a way to go and look back and see all the different things that were happening in the 1980s. And what that required was a huge amount of research. And now this will make it much, much easier for a social historian to come along and write that kind of thing in the future, and to create all kinds of articles that could fit quite nicely in your journal, actually.
Well, that's great. That's great. So, Ross, I was a participant in one of those phone calls that Ashley was talking about. You and I were talking about another topic. It was related to Conan Doyle. And that's how the genesis for this episode came about, as we talked about the Conan Doyle Review. We talked about doings of Doyle. Right. Mark Jones was here on the show on episode 193. We talked about the literary agents, which we haven't mentioned yet, and we'll get to that. We talked about the Arthur Conan Doyle Society, these four kinds of elements. And I think you did a really good job kind of painting an auditory Venn diagram, as it were, with Conan Doyle as the center spot, as the overlap. Can you talk about what those four elements are and how you see these things fitting together, with an accent, as you conclude, on what the Conan Doyle Society is all about.
Certainly. Thanks, Scott. I will give it a try. I will begin, and listeners will not be able to see this, but I guarantee you it's about to happen. Cliff Goldfarb is about to tilt back in his chair and roll his eyes when I report that what I said to Scott was that at the center of everything that's going on, there is Cliff Goldfarb and the Friends of the Conan Doyle Collection in Toronto and the flame they've kept alive pretty much on their own for decades. And that while there is this efflorescence going on of activity and organization in the Doylean world, none of it would have happened. None of this would have been primed to happen if it weren't for the Conan Doyle Collection in general and the Friends and Cliff in particular. So there is that, which is, and him, which is tremendously important at the center. I would also put sort of woven in with that is the work of the Sherlock Holmes Society of France, and in particular, the people who run the Arthur Conan Doyle Encyclopedia website, which is a phenomenal resource, produced and maintained with a professionalism as well as a love of the material that is incomparable. And so what's happened, the Venn diagram, Scott, that you're referring to, is that out of this fertile mix, I think by sort of luck and coincidence, has sprung up a group of new organizations that are not driven by any one particular agenda or any one particular person. It's just a bunch of enthusiasts who happen to have come along roughly all at the same time. And in a way, the granddaddy of that group is Doings of Doyle. Mark Jones and Paul Chapman got this tremendous podcast going, Focus on Conan Doyle. And that is sort of the auditory, that's the radio show about Doyle, right? And then we have the Conan Doyle Review, which is the source of the gravitas of a lot of what's going on now, because not only does it aspire to produce high quality scholarship, but it's being run in a way that is so, so very, very scholarly and professional. So we have this sort of credibility that comes from Ashley, and we have this vivacity that comes from Mark and Paul. And then we have the Conan Doyle Society, which is more of a traditional literary club kind of organization that will also be, sort of performing one of the traditional functions of this kind of literary community. It's the one that's going to be operating, the occasional conference, basically, and also an annual awards ceremony. But then there's this fourth one, which is in a way the most fun and the coolest. And again, your listeners will not be able to hear this, but Ashley is about to chuckle and smirk a little bit because she knows how I'm about to categorize the literary agents, right? Which is led by Mark Jones and Ashley Polasek. It is the Rick's Cafe of the Sherlockian Doylean world. Anyone can show up at the literary agents and they'll get a drink, right? And what they say after they get a drink will stay at Rick's Cafe. And if anyone objects, Ashley and Mark will be shocked that something has been done or said, right? But the literary agents is the, and Ashley used these words, I think, pretty close to them at its first meeting. It is a bridge between the Sherlockian world and the Doylean world. It is a science society of the Baker Street Irregulars, and is going to be part of the BSI weekend. I think the plan, correct me if I'm wrong, Ashley, is every year there's going to be an event, right, of some sort that is going to be this mix of the social and the scholarly. And to give you a sense of the gravitas of their first panel, this is the scholarly part of the literary agents. Cliff Goldfarb was on the first panel along with a couple of other distinguished people, sort of reflecting the range of interest in Doyle. And then they had Douglas Kerr of the Edinburgh Project was their special guest. And so we have the Conan Doyle Society, which is running conferences and prizes. We have the Conan Doyle Review, which is running publishing. We have Doings of Doyle, which is doing broadcasting. We have the Literary Agents, which is building bridges among all of these things, and we are all built to some extent on the backs of Cliff Goldfarb and Alexis Barkeen, right? And how did all of this happen all within the space of a few months? You know, I'm not sure about all the chemistry and the personal dynamics and the organizational dynamics, but I know we all owe a tremendous debt to Cliff and to Alexis, and we're grateful.
And there were a lot of those phone calls from Ross to various people. Don't let him short sell himself.
Oh, I'm sure. This is where that that small ego actually comes into play. I mean, clearly, Ross, you're giving a lot of credit to a lot of people, deservedly so. But, you know, you are kind of the straw in the center of this that stirs the drink at Rick's Cafe, as it were. Incidentally, I love that idea of the literary agents as the Rick's Cafe of science societies. I think I heard someone in there saying, what Doyle? 10 Doyle. Such Doyle. You'll get along splendidly.
Listen, if I show up at the Rick's Cafe of the literary agents, are there going to be letters of transit in the piano?
No comment.
Play it, Bert. You played it for her. You can play it for me.
There you go.
You know, Rick, I trust you because you despise me.
Senor Walder's the fat gent at the table.
I can't say you are a character.
So, for those individuals who are interested in sticking with the program here, when we get to the quiz, the canonical couplet quiz, we'll have a very special prize for you in the form of, well, you'll just have to wait and see, but it has to do with the literary agents. So stay tuned for that. So Ashley, you had the first meeting of the literary agents. I think it was coordinated between you and Mark, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, it was a really good year for us to launch because we wanted to do something that was a virtual event anyway, because as beloved as the BSI weekend is, it's also hugely expensive. And there are so many people who would love to be involved with some of the fun that we have who just can't get there and or have too much sense to go to New York City in January. So we have a virtual event that will allow people to dial in. Mark and I host, and we broke it up into sort of two parts. So I would host a roundtable, and we had wonderful guests. Cliff was one of our guests from our round table discussing Conan Doyle. And then Mark interviewed Douglas Kerr. So it was like a one-on-one interview about his particular project, the Edinburgh Book Project. And there was a very active chat going on, which I was too nervous about the tech to read, but I was told afterwards that there was a lot of enthusiasm, and particularly people were really pleased kind of to have a palate cleanser, because the BSI weekend is so, there's so much codified in the events of the weekend that have a lot to do with the toasts and the papers and the quizzes. And they're wonderful and I love them all, but to have something that was giving space to Conan Doyle and hopefully introducing some people to Conan Doyle who are Sherlockians who may have the interest in exploring, but the sea seemed too big to jump in on their own without a life raft. And so we're kind of giving them that space. So that's what we did. We are looking forward to in the future continuing to have an event that happens in person in the BSI weekend for whoever is there, but also is available as a virtual event live. So people can still tune in and participate even if they're not at the BSI weekend. And we'll continue to do that every year, and we'll have a different theme each year. So we had the state of Conan Doyle as our introductory theme, which was very broad, but we'll probably choose narrower themes going forward just to kind of dip into different areas of Doylean interest.
That's an interesting concept, and I love the idea from going broad to then, you know, starting to pick your verticals, as it were, your niches. But this idea of now moving to, you know, what we have certainly heard bandied about in the business world as a hybrid model of working or of meeting attendance. I think we're going to see more of that because in past years, you were either at the BSI weekend or you weren't. And maybe you caught, you know, a Twitter stream of portions of it, but it still didn't give you a sense of being there, interacting in a meaningful way, or even sampling it. You know, as you mentioned that the literary agents allowed people to do this year. So I think that's really insightful in terms of moving ahead, is offering this kind of hybrid approach where there still will be people in person and other people can tune in from afar virtually. So
yeah, don't get me wrong. Nothing will ever replace being in a room with other people,
certainly,
as I think we are all desperately aware at present. But having the opportunity to let people who can't be there also be there in a way is really important, I think.
Yeah. And Ross, you've been a great mover and shaker in the events world within the Sherlockian groups, particularly the BSI. You know, we had the event in Indianapolis about a year and a half ago. We've had the now twice postponed British Empire coming up. You've been very creative in your event planning and execution. How does this come into play with the Conan Doyle Society?
Well, we'll have to see how it works, but we have some thoughts. And in fact, one of the things that Ashley and I have talked about with respect to the first Conan Doyle Society conference, which, by the way, is planned for the summer of 2023 in London, is that it will be built from scratch, and it's the way we're planning it right now, as a collaborative project in the same way that we're doing so many other things, and built from scratch with an eye to having a live event with live presenters, but full online access to people who can't make it. And one of the reasons why that's so important for our planning for this conference and for structuring ACD Society conferences is we want them to reflect the Doylean world. So the one in 2023 is going to be in London. There are plenty of other countries and continents available for conferences. And so, for example, the idea of going too long without having an ACD Society conference, of course, only with the blessing of the Friends of the ACD Collection, but we have to have one in Toronto, don't we? Yes, yes, we have to have one in Australia. How long will Jay Ganguly allow us to go before having one in India? And if we are going to have a movable Doylean feast, it's going to have to be televised. And so that's going to be a big part, I think, of our conferences, is making them as inclusive live, physically live, as they are online live. And similarly, I mean, just very, very short sketch on this. The way these conferences are going to be set up, again, is collaborative. The Conan Doyle Review basically owns two of the panels for this conference. They're just, you know, we'll provide the room, but it's, I think, Ashley, am I correct? Kate Bromley is really your lead for this. Is that right?
She is, which certainly, I mean, she did so much work with events planning and public outreach and in her archival work with the Portsmouth Library that she's the natural person to do it. She's going to be much better at it than I could be. And I, you know, I'll be there to help and support, but I'm so really delighted to have a team of people who all have wonderful skills that I don't have. and she's one of them, and that's it. So yes, she'll be the point person for that.
So we're going to have the Conan Doyle Review is going to have a couple of panels. Doings of Doyle is going to have a panel. We are hoping, we've invited them, and we're hoping that the Sherlock Holmes Society of France will do a Francophone panel, which would be both interesting and again, I think, mind expanding. And then the one thing that we have not talked about perhaps as much as we might in terms of sort of significance to the work we're doing is the legacy of Chris Roden and the original Arthur Conan Doyle Society. There's a huge volume of superb work out there, one way or another, we're going to find a way to salute and to study as part of our own work. And we very much hope that eventually Chris Roden will appear at one of these events and contribute. It's a very important contributor to the whole history of the appreciation of ACD.
And that's great.
Ross, let me ask you, or Ashley, or Cliff. So we've covered a wide range here: the literary agents, the Conan Doyle Review, the Arthur Conan Doyle Society. So if I have been listening to all of this and I'm really interested, but it sounds like a lot of different things, what's the one first thing I should do?
You should go to the website for the Arthur Conan Doyle Society, the new society, because it's going to be a wonderful clearinghouse. And very helpfully, if you go to that website on the homepage, all along the left side of the screen, you will see links to all of these other things. So it's an organizing space, a clearinghouse for all of the other other projects that are going on.
That is fantastic. And Bert, you took the question right out of my mouth. That's what I was going to ask. So that is fantastic. So we've got societies, we've got events, we've got publications. I mean, Cliff, as you stand back and look at this, as, you know, having been part of the Friends of the Arthur Conan Doyle collection for so long, and now leading it as you do, what are your impressions? What is your thought for the future of Conan Doyle?
Oh, I'm very optimistic. Thank you. That's a good question, because I'm very optimistic for the future. I mean, this is not fully sprung, full grown out of nothing that existed before, a mote of dust or anything. This has been coming for a long time. I remember back when the Baker Street Miscellanea publication, which was fairly short run, announced that they were going to actually include serious articles on Arthur Conan Doyle. And I at the time wrote a letter saying, I hope we'll still be time to play the game. I've changed my mind. I still play the game, but Conan Doyle has been taken seriously by the Baker Street Irregulars and other Sherlockian societies, which wasn't necessarily the case before that. It's just that there's been no organization devoted to Conan Doyle since the old Conan Doyle Society that Chris Roden was leading just became inactive. And I was concerned, because I look around and I've been seeing all these other literary societies for writers I barely even heard of, and also some for people who are very prominent, obviously, and no Conan Doyle Society. And a lot of that was my concern, that Conan Doyle wasn't taken seriously as an author. He was, anyone who writes popular fiction can't be taken seriously as having a thought in his head or her head these days. And Conan Doyle was a public intellectual, as such things are in the UK, not like the public intellectuals in France, but he was the British equivalent. And he had thoughts on a great many things. He was influential in a great many things in society. I mean, just coincidentally, part of what he did led to the creation of a court of criminal appeal in the UK. I mean, this quite a long way away from what you think of as a guy writing detective fiction. So I'm happy to see it. I'm happy that there's enthusiasm. I kind of was hoping someone would pick up the ball, because I decided that I'd rather watch from the sidelines for the most part and let other people do the work. And I can't say enough for Ross. I agree with what Ashley said. Ross's incredible energy, incredible ideas, which he then makes you think you came up with.
That's great.
And I just think that he has to be given a huge amount of credit for the organizational things he's done, and for the, even behind the scenes things that, other people. I mean, someone will tell me something that this the great thing is happening. I said, yeah, Ross is doing it. So the word is getting out there, Ross. You can't keep yourself a secret much longer.
All right, I have to chime in here and point out that Cliff, who is protesting that he's on the sidelines, is chairing one of the committees of the ACD Society. If you go to the ACD Society's website, you will find one of the links is to this, seriously, quite important and thoughtful letter that Cliff wrote in 2019. Basically, it's basically a call to arms for Doylean literati. Cliff is on the sidelines like a player coach is on the sidelines, right? I mean, you are the Lou Boudreau of the Doylean world. So Cliff is retired from Doylean activity the way he retired from his law firm, which is he said he was going to, and then he didn't. He is blessedly addicted to hard work, I think.
Oh boy.
Well, this is marvelous. I mean, this collection of individuals without ego who are getting so much done. It's like the exact opposite of I hear of Sherlock everywhere, where we have great egos and get nothing done. This is, and look, it's the right people who happen to be in the right place at the right time with the right idea. Clearly, everyone here is motivated. Clearly, everyone here is well-educated in their particular area of Conan Doyle. And I think bringing these together with an organizer of the likes of Ross and of Ashley and of Cliff is fantastic. So thank you all for joining us here on I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. And we will look for much more coming out of the Conan Doyle Society, the Literary Agents, Doings of Doyle, and the Conan Doyle Review.
Thanks very much, Scott.
Thank you.
How appropriate all of this is around Arthur Conan Doyle, you know, beyond his literary accomplishments. We talked about so many of them with the group. People don't know. It's thanks to Conan Doyle. He was an early promoter of a channel tunnel between Britain and the continent. His concern for the safety of men at sea and soldiers led to the development of life rafts. He had an enormous influence. And the other thing that occurs to me is how happy, you know, we mentioned Adrian and Dennis, his sons, who were perturbed when they discovered that the Baker Street Irregulars was completely focused on Sherlock Holmes and dismissed, apparently seemed to be dismissing his father, how thrilled they would be, you know. And the root, of course, of their irritation was that for some reason the family chose Hesketh Pearson to do the first, I guess, authorized biography of Conan Doyle. And Pearson was an actor and a writer who did popular biographies. He did a biography of George Bernard Shaw, and he did a biography of Shakespeare, and he did Charles Darwin, I think. And he wrote a book about Conan Doyle, and basically he said Conan Doyle's genius was he was just like every man. He was sort of a happy, simple, down-at-the-pub kind of a guy. And that, you know, they were aghast at that because they felt that their father's unique contribution was, you know, not understood by the biographer. So how thrilled they would be to see this renaissance. It's not even a renaissance, this emergence of interest in a really valuable character like Arthur Conan Doyle.
Yeah, I mean, and it's really an idea whose time has come. You know, I mean, we talked about this with everyone, but you know, it's been happening for quite some time, and it's no accident that folks should be, you know, coordinating now, because there's stuff that's been in the water already. You know, this is not news to most people who have been following Conan Doyle and all of his exploits. It's just you got the right people, as I said, around the right idea at the right time. March is here, and MX Publishing is marching on with more Kickstarter projects, two to be exact. and you won't want to miss them. The first is a two-volume series called Sherlock Holmes, The Hero with a Thousand Faces by David McGregor. This set ambitiously takes on the task of explaining the continued popularity of Conan Doyle's famous detective over the course of three centuries. The old proverb says, success has many fathers, failure is an orphan. Well, who then is responsible for the creation of Sherlock Holmes? Certainly Arthur Conan Doyle, from whose pen he sprang, but there were thousands of other influences as well, from real-life professionals to characters in literature, societal forces, and of course, the men who played him on stage and screen. David McGregor does a comprehensive job of identifying many of the thousands of faces that brought Sherlock Holmes to life. The second Kickstarter project is a three-volume series in the MX Book of New Sherlock Holmes Stories, volumes 25, 26, and 27, each ranging from 1881 to 1887, 1888 to 1897, and 1898 to 1927, respectively. In it, you will get 59 new Sherlock Holmes adventures in these three companion volumes. It's been 6 years since the first three volumes of the MX Book of New Sherlock Holmes Stories arrived that had over 60 stories in the true canonical manner. But readers have said they wanted more, and over the course of the run, the series has grown to nearly 600 new Holmes adventures by almost 200 contributors from around the world. Don't miss out this return to Baker Street and discover more authentic adventures of Sherlock Holmes. You'll find links to both of these projects in the show notes for this episode and also by going to mxpublishing.com. Well, that music means it's the right time for everyone's favorite Sherlockian quiz show. That's right, it's Canonical Couplets, where we bring you two lines of poetry, and you have to guess which Sherlock Holmes story it came from. Now, last time we were in these parts, and this is always a challenge, and I'm girding myself for Bert's answer, but last time we were here, we gave you this clue. Begun with pleasant lassitude, from a bath and then a smoke, the flame-like woman finished with a packet neath her cloak. Bert, do you know which story we're referring to?
Oh, yes. You know, this is about a famous, one of the few blackmail cases Sherlock Holmes was involved in. It's the blackmail case about the pistol that was hidden in a wheel of cheese. This is The Adventure of the Jarlsberg Rusty Silver Gun.
Oh, my gosh. You amaze me every time, Bert. Sometimes in a good way, too. That's the most remarkable part. Well, no, that's not exactly what we were looking for this time around. And our good friend Eric Deckers had a guess that was almost as good as yours. He said, it's a story about the Budweiser horse who went on to enjoy a successful career as a shampoo model. It's The Adventure of the Lustrous Clydesdale. No.
Oh, I like that. That's
good. It was close, even closer than you, Bert. No, in this case, we're looking for the illustrious client. And we did get a handful of guesses. We need more people to participate because this is getting too easy for the regulars. So we're going to put the irregulars into the barrel, and we're going to give the big prize wheel a spin. Wait for it to slow down, and it eventually stops, landing on number 11. Number 11. And that goes to Rich Criscunas. Rich, congratulations to you, my fellow Detroiter. We will have a prize available to you. Now, you get to pick, Rich, because if you recall, we interviewed Rich Ryan in the last episode, one of the editors of Dear Holmes, and a multi-author on MX Publishing. So, Rich, if you want to look on Rich Ryan's page on MX Publishing and pick the title that works for you, then we will get right on that. In the meantime, we are here with the next canonical couplet. Bert, are you ready?
I'm ready. I'm ready.
All right, here we go. Weary after months of work, no need for an apology, for 25 deductions by a master of graphology. If you know the answer to this canonical couplet, put it in an email address to comment@IHearOfSherlock.com with canonical couplet in the subject. If you are among the correct answers and we choose you at random, you will win. Now, we didn't mention exactly what people would win before the quiz, but it is a unique item. Well, not exactly unique, but it's a rare item. It is a pin from the Literary Agents. That's right, the group that Ashley founded. It's a lovely lapel pin. It looks like the old Parker dual-fold pen that Conan Doyle used to use, and there is the Literary Agents across the barrel. It's about 2 or 3 inches long, and it has two backs to it. It's a wonderful brass-colored pin. So if you answer this canonical couplet correctly, we will give you this lapel pin. So stay tuned for that. Well, Bert, I guess we've done it again.
Well, we had a lot of help. That was a very good conversation. And it's a lovely, lovely little milestone here around Conan Doyle. Very gratifying.
It is. It is gratifying indeed. And we hope that you will remember to gratify us by subscribing either via email or on whatever podcast platform of your choice. Follow us on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your audio entertainment. And, of course, sign up for our email list, and we will give you updates on all things related to Sherlock Holmes. Also, if you haven't yet, check out our other weekly podcast, Trifles, where we talk about some of the minutiae in the Sherlock Holmes stories. Until next time, I remain the minute Scott Monty.
And I'm the slightly more substantial Bert Wilder.
And together we say,
the game's afoot.
The game's afoot.
I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I am neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.